or fairly close to it. Continuing our class, entering the last third of it, a little less than that actually, on the evangelistic church being an inside-out kind of church. And before we dive in, Brother Kent agreed to say a word of prayer for us, and we'll get started. I was told that sometimes when I put the microphone up on this stand, which is convenient for the devotionals, but when I teach class, I turn the other direction and then you can't hear me anymore. So I'm going to try it back on my lapel. It may make me too loud. I don't know. We'll figure it out. We're continuing, so looking at evangelism. And tonight we're going to start looking more at the individual. The class as a whole has been about the church and what the church needs to do. But, of course, that has to play out in the individual life. So we're going to take a little bit of a look at that beginning tonight. And we're going to start with a story. I like church history. That doesn't come as a surprise to anybody. There it goes. This is a story from earlier part of church history, a story of a fellow named Basil. His mother didn't name him Basil the Great, but history did. Let me just read this out of the text. Now, the first true hospital in the Western world, the first true hospital in the Western world was the Basiliad in Asia Minor. The Romans had medical institutions to care for soldiers and slaves, as well as temples of the god Asclepius, where believers went to pray for miraculous healing. But the Basiliad was the first medical center open to all, with healthcare professionals on site and provisions for caring for the indigent. The Basiliad had more than 300 beds for the care of the sick. It included hospice care and a leprosy house, as well as a ward for sick travelers. Funded entirely by donations from wealthy Christians, the complex also included a soup kitchen and an orphanage. This center of care for the sick and needy was named after one of its founders, Basil, Bishop of Caesarea. Born into a wealthy family, Basil gave away what he had and dedicated himself to church work. He came to be an influential leader in the early church. Basil was a staunch defender of the doctrine of the Trinity, fiercely opposing those who would deny the deity of Christ. And that's true. I had a professor make me read all that. His text on that's pretty interesting. The Roman Emperor Valens disagreed with Basil on this point and attempted to exile the cleric several times. Basil refused to leave, and when Emperor Valens finally went to see Basil in person, he ended up giving a donation to the Basiliad. It was said of Basil, his words were like thunder because his life was like lightning. So the idea is this was a fella whose works were of such character that it became very hard to disagree with him. His works were of such character that it made what he said, which was pretty good already, more persuasive. And so what the text for tonight we're looking at wants us to consider is how individual Christians can do that. We all want to have great big swelling persuasive words which change people's minds, but you don't get to have those unless there is a life, in particular a servant-oriented life, that backs it up. Where do we learn about the servant-oriented life? We learn about this, predictably, from Jesus. If you want to look in the 13th chapter of John, a story that I suspect is well known to you, John chapter 13, Somebody would like to read verses 3 through 5. I love that verse 3 comes first and points out, is Jesus acting like a servant because he's confused about who he is? No, Jesus is acting like a servant because he knows who he is. Right? Because he knows who he has no problem being a servant. I think it's people who have a lot of insecurity who try to look like they're more than they are. Jesus doesn't have that problem. He knows exactly who he is. So it doesn't demean him in any way to be a servant. Quite the opposite. Jesus washed the feet of all 12 apostles, unless we forget. This includes Peter, who's going to argue with him, and Judas Iscariot, who is going to betray him in a matter of hours. And Jesus is aware of it, and he's going to mention it in the text. Right? In verses 12 through 17, he explains the teaching of this. Who has verses 12 through 17? Bobby, thank you. So the lesson that this was supposed to teach was about the value of service and the priority of service in life. That it actually takes a priority over other things we might want to be about. That no person is exempt from service. Now, just to be fair to the rest of the Bible for a minute, and we'll talk about this later in the lesson as well, everybody has to find areas of service where they are best using the resources and abilities they have from God. So, for example, the apostles said, it's not good for us to serve and wait on tables when we could be preaching the gospel in Acts chapter 6. They're not saying it's bad to wait on tables. They're just saying they had a particular job they needed to do that nobody else could do in that case. There wasn't a B team of apostles ready to get up and do it if they were busy with the tables. So, fair enough, and we will mention this later, everyone needs to find jobs that are appropriate and recognize that difference in abilities and resources that we have. But there's nobody who is above service. There's not a servant class and then the other folk. Everybody participates in service. And I love that this ends in verse 17. If you know these things, then you're blessed? No. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. Which seems to imply knowing these things and not doing them would not only be a blessing, I wonder if it's not a curse. That to go to judgment knowing the servanthood of Jesus and refusing to participate in it yourself. He said, blessed are you if you do them. Mark chapter 10, we see an example where Jesus also is trying to teach this to his disciples. Now, to be fair, this is before the washing of the feet. So we'll cut the sons of thunder a little bit of slack here because they haven't had their feet washed yet. But still, they're in a lot of trouble. Okay, Mark chapter 10. Who wants to read for us verse 35 through 37 about James and John? James, thank you.
James,
Yep, that's good. So, James and John, sons of Zebedee. What's another name they get sometimes? Yeah, some sons of thunder, right? I gather, now I don't know exactly what that means. It could have been an inside joke I don't just get. But if you call somebody a son of thunder, I assume he's not really passive. This is not the quiet sort, right? These were two outspoken fellows, is what I would gather. Okay? And that kind of fits with what they ask. They're natural leaders. They're naturally outspoken. And so it just makes sense to them. Jesus, let's go ahead and put it in writing, as it were. Let's go ahead and make it official. We're clearly the leaders of the group. Let's have one of us on the left and one of us on the right. In another gospel account, who asks? Mom does, yeah. So I don't know if this happened more than once or if this is just a more involved story and Mom is here, but she's just not mentioned in Mark because the request clearly involves James and John too. But in any event, I mean, there was more than one person, at least, that saw James and John and say, these ought to be the leaders. At least they did, and their mama did. Okay? And that's the request that they make. What is Jesus' response then in verses, there's a lot of response here, but it's particularly, who wants to read 42 through 45? Jim. So the first comparison is to the Gentiles. How do Gentile lords act if you're a powerful Gentile person? Well, in this case, you act just like James and John. You're ambitious, you look for a position to get a promotion into, and you go after that because that's where you belong. And you lord it over other people, and you give instructions. That's what power looks like in the Gentile world. To be fair, it's what it looked like in the Jewish world too, but what Jesus is trying to say is we're supposed to be like this. We're supposed to be different. We're supposed to know better. The Gentiles act that way. You should know better. And so instead, he says, as far as my disciples go, the great one will be a servant. And I don't just think, let me spell this out again, I don't just think he's saying if you're a really good servant all the days of your life, one of these days when you die, God will flip it upside down and put you in charge of something in heaven or something. I don't think that's the point. I think he's saying that service is how his disciples will exercise leadership. Okay, it's not don't worry about leadership now and one of these days you'll get it. It's the person who will be a leader now is a servant. And Jesus uses himself as an example. As we said, he knows exactly who he is. His power and position is not in question. But he has come to live as a life of service. How much service? To the extent of sacrificing himself. Most of us are comfortable with service until it becomes inconvenient. Kind of a joke, right? I mean, that's the point of service, is it's not convenient. It's helping somebody else and not you. But most of us like service until it actually gets in the way of something we want to do, or costs us something we don't want to pay, or affects us negatively. What is Jesus' view of service to the point of giving his own life? So that's the view of how Christians are going to live among themselves. But also then, it tells us about how we're going to live in the world. How are we going to act among those who are not Christians? It doesn't make any sense for Jesus to say, act this way amongst yourselves and then go out there and lord it over them like the Gentiles, right? Now, this is the way Christians act in all of their different circumstances of life. However they find themselves, they're going to carry this conduct with them. We want a voice like thunder and power to match. We want to be able to say words and the heavens shake, right? But what Jesus teaches is the way to be influential is not to yell louder, it's to work harder. Greater service leads to greater influence and leadership. The early church figured this out. So I already told you the story of Basil the Great, which is the Western world's first hospital. Here's another set of stories. This comes from a letter by Emperor Julian. Okay, so who's Emperor Julian? Julian is the emperor who follows the Christianization of Rome. So after they make Christianity more or less legal in Rome, Julian is the next one, and he does not like it. He's sometimes called Julian the Apostate. He would like to go back to the old gods. And so he writes letters to the priests, and we still have those letters. He writes letters to the old pagan priests and says, you know, we've got a problem with these Galileans. Which is funny, right? Because this is a couple of centuries after the first century. They hadn't been Galileans for a long time. But Jesus was a Galilean. That's in his mind, you know, it's those Galileans. That's our problem. Those Jewish Galileans, that's terrible. And so we have his letters to the priest where he's complaining about how influential the Christians are in Rome. He'd like to fix that. Here's what he says. It is disgraceful that when no Jew ever has to beg, and the impious Galileans support not only their own poor, but ours as well, all men see that our people lack aid from us. He says that this is an embarrassment, that we're not doing good works. He says, no, it's an embarrassment that they're doing so many. They're making us look bad. The Jewish people always get fed. In fact, the Romans get fed by the Jewish people. It's the Galileans, those impious Galileans. Okay? And here's another quote from the letters. For when it came about that the poor were neglected and overlooked by the priests, talking about the Roman priests, then I think the impious Galileans observed this fact and devoted themselves to philanthropy. And they have gained ascendancy in the worst of their deeds, through the credit they win for such practices. What's he saying? Well, these Christians can just get away with murder because they help everybody. And so he makes it sound like it's sinister, like the Christians decided, you know, it would be good. Let's help people, and that will do it, right? Like it was some kind of plot that we came up with. He just can't imagine that anyone actually wants to help anybody. He just says, these sneaky Galileans just keep feeding poor people, and now everyone listens to them. And he's really, you can see just the corruption in this man's heart, that he just cannot see Christianity as a group of people who might actually just want to do good. And that genuine credibility, and you can't buy that. That genuine credibility persuaded people. Julian loses. The empire goes back to Christendom of some kind in the future. He doesn't get his way. Much as he tries to get rid of Christianity in Rome, it doesn't work out. Because the Christians just had too much credibility, because they were most powerful speakers on earth. You can read all the letters of Julian, and he never talks about how clever their preachers were. He never mentions Basil the Great's great letter on the Trinity. It never comes up. He talks about they just keep helping people. And everybody likes that. You can almost hear the sarcasm. Everybody likes that. We can see this principle in the teachings of Christ, and I think there's two passages that kind of balance each other out a little bit. I want to read them back to back. Let's look in Matthew. This is the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to look at chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6, verses 1 through 4. Bobby, if you'd read that for us. So this passage does talk about that giving is not something we do to garner attention for ourselves. And Christians have often been guilty of that and always been accused of that, even when it's not true. But sometimes it is true. Okay. I did some research today. I was just out on the internet looking around. I was trying to find statistics of charitable giving for people claiming to be Christians versus people claiming to be atheists. I was curious who gave more. And I never did find the statistics that really compelled me one way or the other, because it turns out Christians have one set of books and the atheists had a different set of books. So I wasn't convinced of the data. But anyway, while I was doing that, I kind of went down a different rabbit hole. And it was lots of atheists writing articles for the Times and Huffington Post and different places saying, well, atheists give plenty. We just don't brag about it like Christians do. And that was kind of their way to explain away the statistics that seemed to kind of lean the other direction. Though, again, I wasn't convinced entirely. It seems like Christians typically give more of their income per capita. But the atheists, their complaint was, well, Christians, we're just not as showy as those Christians are. Okay. A lot of times that is a silly accusation. But the fact that Jesus brings it up means that sometimes it must be true. Sometimes we can do it in order to attract attention to ourselves. Look at how pious I am. Again, largely because of insecurity. I don't think I'm a very good person, so I need you to tell me. look, watch as I do this. Right? Jesus has a lot of stories related to this. You remember they're standing by the treasury in the temple, and everyone's coming by and throwing in their magnificent sacks of gold, and the widow comes by with her mite, and Jesus says, that one. That's the one who gave. So Jesus is quite often suspicious of people who give ostentatiously. Okay. However, that does not mean, even when he says, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that giving by Christians is an entirely secretive enterprise. Look in Matthew chapter 5. Can somebody read for us verses 14 through 16? Matthew chapter 5, 14 through 16. Jerry, thank you. There's a little different point of it, and I think you have to read both of these passages together. If you just read one or the other, you would come away with a bad idea, I think. But this passage definitely emphasizes God doesn't intend to hide his kingdom's good works. Quite the opposite. He intends to be glorified by the good of the kingdom. You wouldn't light a candle to hide it, would you? That's Jesus' point, right? You wouldn't put it under a bushel. Even the kids know that one. Put it under a bushel. Nope. Right? That's not the way it goes. So that's not the point of it. So the way I would read these two passages, and remember, they're in the same sermon. So Jesus clearly didn't think they were in conflict. He means both of them. I would take it like this. Service and giving are never to be done in order to receive the praise of men for ourselves. Service and giving are always to be done in order to receive the praise of men God. So there is supposed to be a praise-filled response. The goal of Christians is to do it in such a way that it doesn't get directed at us, but at God. What I'd really like to hear is those Christians are so generous, not Ben Williams is generous. The church is generous, not Ben Williams is generous. That somehow, and that's a sticky, fine line to walk, isn't it? Really is. But that would be the goal, I think, of Jesus' teachings. The Pharisees that he complains about seem to have failed on one side of attracting attention to themselves. This week's sermon coming up on Sunday is from Matthew chapter 23. It's as close as I ever get to hellfire and brimstone. It is the ugliest, rebuke-filled chapter of the book of Matthew, and most of it is about this point. Jesus telling people, stop being showy. He is angry. When you think of Jesus angry, you think of maybe the whip in the temple. I think of Matthew 23. It is Jesus, if you read the text the way it's written, he is nigh to yelling. The words just come one after point after point after point after point. And as soon as he wraps one up, he's on to the next. He's got this about this showy kind of thing. So how does a church walk that line? I'll just give you some these are Ben's off-the-cuff guidelines. I should pick on Bill. Bill has done a fair bit of fundraising and good works and kindness towards fellow man in his day, so we might have some comments from Bill in a second. But in general, Christians never advertise what we have. You know, when the politician fixes a street pothole, what do? They put a sign next to it that says, fixed by, right? Paid for by funding, right? Because they want you to know who did that thing. Christians don't say, look at what I did. Christians quite often say, look at what I'm doing, in order to be able to help the greatest number of people. So we do, and not for online, but we do reach out to say, we're looking for hungry people. We're not hiding the fact that we are willing to help hungry people. We have coats, but we don't really want anyone to have them. We're happy for people to know. So in the little sacks that we send home with the kids in Glenville schools every week, put a little card in there that says provided by the Church of Christ and information about what's going on there, just so they know to connect with it. And that works. Sarah Halstead teaches at the school down there, one of ours in Glenville School, and had that correct. They were just talking, working at a church, Glenville Church of Christ. You're the guys that do the food. Somewhere she had seen one of those cards. We don't have it on a billboard anywhere. Look at what we do. In the process of the work itself, we call attention to the church. See how that's different than a billboard that says, look what we do. That's a fine line. I don't think the church does a lot of advertising and marketing. That's what for-profit businesses do. But we do try to make sure it's clear that the good things we do are clearly connected with the church so that God can be glorified, as opposed to some human organization or some person. Fine line. It's tricky, but fun. Oh. Yeah. Is it Bob said? Yeah. You're not putting up a billboard that says, we give out candy. But you're the same thing. Yeah. And I'll show you how that's supposed to work out. Now, you're not supposed to brag on yourself when you do good. But I'm allowed to brag on you when you do good. So we have several ladies here who participate in our Mark 10 program. I'm biased. One of them is my wife. And then a lot of you give charitably to that program to put the food in the sacks for the school. We got an email the other day here at the church, and here's the text. It says, I hope I'm reaching the right people, but I believe you make snack bags for Glenpool Elementary. Thank you for, and by the way, the dot, dot, dot. She had been emailing different churches trying to find the one that did it. And so think about the effort involved. Yeah, you think you look at the card, right? But she thought she found the right church, and it wasn't them. So they said, no, it's not us. So she kept looking. She was determined to find the church that had done that. Anyway, say thank you so much for what you do. I work full-time, have 3 kids at home, 10, 11, and 15. I also have a 20-year-old in college in Colorado. I'm currently going through a separation, probably divorce, because my husband started drinking again, and I'm suspecting using meth again. It is very hard emotionally and financially, as well as spiritually. But those snack bags my daughter brings home is so thoughtful and helpful. They look forward to the snacks, and it helps with after school until I get home, and even dinner supplement is part of their meal that night usually. I don't receive food stamps, so it is extremely helpful. If you have time, could you please share this message with your staff, congregation, and let them know the generous gesture is appreciated and a relief. Also, if you could please pray for my family and I would appreciate it. The holidays would be hard with our family split up and sad. Thank you, and God bless you all for using some of your money to help. This is a person who wasn't just grateful, who actually went out of their way to chase us down to be grateful. This isn't just a leper that comes back. This is someone who chased us down to find out, make sure the right church got credit. And then I had a chance to follow up today and email her. I said, what else, Kimmy? It sounds like your family's going through a hard time. She said, you're struggling spiritually. I would love to talk to you about what's going on. Oh, well, yeah, actually, conversation begins right. But it starts with, she talked to a lot of preachers before she talked to me. But this was the church that gave food to her kids. And so I'm the one that gets to have the conversation with her. Okay. And again, it's different. It's not just like advertising and marketing, where you're spending money to get people's attention. We're doing something that legitimately helps people in the first place, that is good all on its own merit. And as a natural byproduct of doing something genuinely good for people genuinely in need, they know where to go with their even greater needs when they would like to say a word. And she drops that in there about spiritually. That is a subtle hint. I would be open to a little follow-up conversation. Here's an email back. I don't know where to go, maybe nowhere. But that's an opportunity that we got because somebody stuck some food in the sack. Okay. That's the life like lightning. It's the behavior that allows the words you speak to have more credibility. Okay. Does that make sense? Which is the last thing that person wants. Yeah. As Jesus taught. Other Jerry, yes. She's about to be, because I asked her, she mentioned holidays, and so I asked her, I know we do some stuff around Christmas and Thanksgiving, so I said, how about that? So we're getting her on the list. Only thing she asked is that I not put her name on the screen, because she has a 15-year-old son who's going to get portrait school. So things we... good works. I'm around time. Let me hit these just one after the other without turning to each one. You can look them up later if you want. Good works are our purpose. Ephesians 2:15. We are created in Christ Jesus for good works. It is what God has made us to do. Good works are our passion. Titus 2:14. Paul talks about creating a church that is zealous for good works. That's the kind of people that Titus was supposed to be cultivating. Create people that are zealous for good works. Works are our devotion, by which I mean it's what we're devoted to. It's where our priorities are. Titus 3:8 talks about they are given, have given themselves to good works. They've made it their goal. Works are our credibility. 1 Peter 2:12 talks about people who are suffering as Christians, but let your good works go out in front of you so that they'll be ashamed to accuse you of anything. Basil the Great, emperor comes down to throw him out of town and instead makes a donation to the hospital. It kind of gets embarrassing at some point to throw rocks at people who behave that well. And good works are our gospel. Let me read this passage because I thought it was fascinating. 2 Corinthians 9:12-13. For the ministry of this service is not only supplying the needs of the saints, that is also overflowing in many thanksgivings to God. By their approval of the service, they will glorify God because of your submission that comes from your confession of the gospel of Christ and the generosity of your contribution for them and for all others. The giving, coupled with the confession, proclaimed the gospel. And God was being glorified by those two things working together. Christ-confessing people through Christ-proclaiming works, God is glorified by that as they give. I wanted to get ahead of this. Turn to Romans chapter 12, and let's talk about the process of Christian service. I wanted to spend at least a couple minutes on this, because in my experience, this is usually where the wheels come off. I've never met anybody that says, I'm opposed to good works. It's kind of a definition of good. We all like them. Right? Most people like the idea of doing good things. But in a church, especially a sizable one, even a medium-sized one like us, the challenge is to make sure people have opportunities to serve. But that's a challenge, because you can just put in the bulletin, here's 50 things you can do this week, and you'll find out people don't do them. And it's not because they don't want to, but because it's really a challenge to connect people with good intentions to something that needs to be done and get them active in that and feel confident to be able to do it. Romans chapter 12, 3 through 8, is helpful to me. It's one of the passages in the New Testament about gifts. In the Corinthian epistle, when it talks about gifts, it's nearly all in reference to miraculous manifestations of gifts. But in Romans, not at all. The word gift has a very broad meaning. I hadn't noticed this until I worked through it years ago. Romans chapter 12, 3 through 8. For by the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think with sober judgment, each according to the measure of faith that God has assigned. Okay, first of all, you hear the servant language already. Don't think of yourself above others. Okay. You think about what God has given you to do. Verse 4. For as in one body we have many members, the members do not all have the same function. Well, that sounds just like 1 Corinthians 12. So we, though many, are one body in Christ and individually members one of another. Yeah, it could be copied right out of 1 Corinthians 12. But listen to where he goes. Having gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, let us use them. And here comes the list. Now, what are the gifts he has in mind? The first one doesn't surprise you. If prophecy, in proportion to our faith, if you have the miraculous gift of prophecy, you should use that, Paul says. Yeah, this makes sense. Okay. He tells Timothy, don't hide or resist or misuse the gift that's in you. You've been given a gift by the laying on of hands. He says, you go use it. But then you see what's next. If service in our serving, the capacity to serve, having the strength and opportunity to serve, is here called a gift, right next to prophecy. Now, this is different than 1 Corinthians, where the list, again, is almost entirely miraculous. It's tongue speaking and then other things. Here, in his mind, in this passage, the ability to serve is a gift from God. Not everybody has it. The strength, the health, you meet people who, I'd like to do that, my health just won't allow it. And some people, in certain seasons of life, you have the strength and the ability to go and do, like physically, service to others. He says that's a blessing from God. It's a gift in that sense. So if you have that, serve. The one who teaches in his teaching. Now, James 3:1 says not everybody's supposed to be a teacher. But Paul says if that is a gift of God to you, could mean something miraculous, but he doesn't spell that out, does he? If that's a gift of God to you, then you should teach. The one who exhorts in his exhortation. What's exhortation? Building up, encouragement, consolation is another way it's translated. Consoling someone. Okay. That's something different, by and large, than just teaching and instruction. Some people are better at that than others. Okay. I'll be blunt. I'm not usually the person you want when you're feeling blue and want someone to cheer you up. I'm usually the one that says, yeah, that's terrible. Okay. Sometimes I do better than others, but I'm not always the best guy for that. There are people, though, that you get around them and you go, oh, that's the person I want to talk to when I'm down. When I feel like I can't go to church and I feel like I'm not getting my life right, that's the person I want to talk to. Okay. Some people are better at that. Also, that's a gift of God. The one who contributes in generosity. The money in your wallet, well, this sounds like Sunday morning sermon. The money in your wallet is a gift of God. in a similar way that he gave some people in Corinth the gift of tongue speaking, he gave some people in Rome enough money to give it away. And he says, it all comes from God. If that's what God's giving you, then you have generosity with it. And you're under the same obligation with that money as a prophet is with his ability to prophesy. A prophet who doesn't prophesy, he's in trouble. Person with wealth who doesn't give is under the same kind of judgment. A teacher who doesn't teach. Dad told me one time, don't be a preacher if you can do anything else. And here I am. And what he meant by that was, if you can find a way to talk yourself out of it, do something else. If there's no burden of morality and conscience upon you to do it, don't do it. And I tried a few times to do other things, and I kept ending up preaching. There was a moral burden when I wasn't preaching, when I was doing other work, even though I was making a considerable amount of money in sales. I was pretty good at it, it turns out. There was a moral burden. Okay. That's the point we make here. The one who leads with zeal. Some people are natural leaders. Maybe those sons of thunder really were. Maybe they were naturally gifted. He did call them to be apostles for a reason. And maybe they really were. He says, go get it. Charge. I've got a minister friend. He likes to joke that if we ever could put the two of us together, we'd have one good minister between the two of us. Because he's good at quite a lot of things I'm bad at, and vice versa. But one of the comments he was saying to me just the other day is, he said, when the two of us have a project we'd like to do, I always make sure you know about it, because you're the one who's going to go do it. And he says, I tend to think about it too much. Which is funny, because I think of myself as a thinking person. And he says, no, you're the go-getter. Some people have a project and they dive in to the deep end and say, hey, let's do that, even before they think it through sometimes. But with zeal, they say, let's go do it, let's charge. Okay, that's something that people need to do. The one who acts of mercy with cheerfulness. There's Basil. If you're going to open a hospital, you be happy about it. Don't open a miserable hospital. We've got plenty of those. If you're going to open an orphanage to take care of children, be happy about it. Have cheerfulness in that service. So the point is, there are different areas of service. You have to identify it. So step one, identify needs, what needs to be done. Step two, recognize what Paul here very broadly, more so than in the Corinthian letter, very broadly calling gifts. What is it that I have at my disposal? Maybe it is money. Maybe it is teaching. Maybe it is leadership. Maybe it is I'm just a merciful person who never gets tired of helping people. Maybe I'm encouraging people who never gets tired of encouraging people. Whatever that is, recognize that, and then put the two together. Find ways to put that thing that you have at your disposal, that God has given you, where God needs work to be done. Rules for service. I'm not going to get all through these. I'm going to try. One, leaders, if you want a church that is serving, need to be affirming while guiding good works. That's a very delicate balance. That the congregation needs guidance, because people come up with well-intended ideas that sometimes are terrible ideas. Okay, but at the same time, you don't want to say no. No, 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 no. If you tell everybody no all the time, they stop coming up with good ideas. And so you find a way to say, I like your good intentions. Let's find a way to steer that in a good direction. Number two, make your priority outside the walls. If you're looking for needs, start out there. Number three, complaints are offers to help. Good policy for any church. Someone says they don't like it, oh good, you can do it. That's how Debbie gets all of her teachers now. She says it to me a lot. She says, complaints are just people offering to help. Don't you know that, Ben? Number four, announcements are a call to action. We have announcements or bulletin announcements. We don't want those to just be, by the way, here's something that's happening. Our goal is for you to hear that and say, oh, I could get involved in that. I could do something. Prayer for needs. Ask God to call up workers. Sometimes I don't know how to fix a problem. It's good to pray about it. It's good for the church to pray about it. And quite often, a solution develops because of the prayerful life of the church, and opportunities come to bear. Number six, ministries which outlive their purpose are given the freedom to die. Don't keep doing things just because we did them. Find the things that you have the right people to do, the needs that need to be met, and do it. If we don't have one or the other of those, find what we do have. I think that's the challenge. Can we end with a verse? But someone will say, you have faith and I have works. James says, show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works.